Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Sam Wong, your host. Julian Zelizer is away on book deadline. We should all wish him well as he does that. As everyone knows, Politics and Polls is the podcast of Princeton University and of the Woodrow Wilson School. I, Sam Wong, am a professor here and founder of the Princeton Election Consortium. Today, we have a very interesting topic, the true threats to democracy, whether left, center, or right. And we are joined by David Adler. David Adler is a writer and researcher based in London. He's written on a range of topics relating to today's subject, including populism, threats to democracy, and economic inequality. In his own research, he focuses on the political economy of urban development, how cities change, how social movements respond to these changes, and how governments respond to those movements. He's a recent Rhodes Scholar. You can read his research and writing at davidrkadler.info. So, David, welcome to Politics and Polls.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, today, what I really wanted to get into is the subject of populism and authoritarianism. And what we've really seen a lot in the last few years, I think, really prominently in Europe, in the United States, is the rise of these outsider movements that have destabilized politics, that have brought in new players, whether in France or in the United States and elsewhere, players who have not previously been engaged in politics, seemingly, Italy as well. And it's a really striking phenomenon. Living in the United States, I thought of it as Trumpism, where this outsider hijacked the Republican Party and took over. But it seems to be a striking phenomenon. Many people think of these things as coming from the right, and there's been, I think, as you've written, lots of research on extremist parties. But in a piece that you wrote a few months ago in the New York Times, you pointed out a different kind of threat to democratic institutions, and that really struck me as an interesting starting point for what I would say is a bit of a contrarian view to what people think of as the threat to democracy. And so in your piece on May 23rd in the New York Times, you reported what you call the centrist paradox. And so I wanted to kick off today by talking about that centrist paradox. And maybe if I could hear from you a little, we could hear from you a little bit about like your framing of what you found out when you looked into the data.
Absolutely. Yeah, so 2016 was this earthquake in political science. You know, it was to our field what 2008 was to economists, in that all of a sudden it felt like a lot of the theories that we felt we understood quite well sort of fell apart. And we started to worry about things like democratic deconsolidation, right, where democracy would cease to be the only game in town. And now we see this mountain of literature emerging about how democracies die, et cetera. And, you know, one of the big efforts in that process is to make sense of the origins of a lot of these problems, you know, understanding, for example, why there is this prominent decline in support for democracy among voters. And, you know, and in the classic conversation, this divides between two types of explanations. Some people look at economic factors. There's a lot of literature about the effects of trade and the so-called China shock, which can breed a kind of economic anxiety that is sort of fruitful ground for populists to prey. Others point to more sociological demographic factors like race or changes in migration, which can breed a kind of resentment. And then, of course, there's a third explanation, which is more generational, thinking about age cohorts where young people who never fought in those great wars are a bit more distant from democracy as a great ideal and therefore are less invested. Now, what I found when I was looking at these data and I was doing a kind of review of that literature is that for some reason, no one had looked at the distribution of democratic attitudes across the political spectrum. And there was a good reason for that, which was that, you know, there's this implicit assumption that makes a lot of sense to me that the threat was coming from the political extremes. There was some kind of elective affinity between very extreme political views, radical views, and support for strongmen to come and implement those views. So my paper set out to test that implicit assumption, looking at these big bodies of survey data, the World Value Survey, European Value Survey, which had been very prominent and popular, if problematic, in this literature.
We get to drill in a little bit here. So these surveys, sure. The World Value Survey and the European Value Survey, tell a little bit about these. Are these done in Europe or around the world?
World Value Survey is done around the world, I believe every 10 years for the World Value Survey. Uh-huh. European Value Survey is done every 5 years. There's more waves of the latter. And you know they're across, they're transnational. So the European Value Survey is, I believe, 47 countries across Europe. World Value Survey includes a much larger smattering of countries. and they ask, you know, a range of social and political questions. And these surveys have been are like I said, they're very they're limited in many important ways, but they provide very an opportunity to compare public opinion across a wide range of countries, sort of cross-sectionally. So that's seem like an obvious place to start, not least because in other papers and, you know, in the same body of literature, these were used as kind of the litmus tests for the degradation of democracy and the decline of citizen support for these systems.
Now, a few years ago, there was a big kerfuffle by, I think, Yasha Mauck and, if I remember correctly, co-author Foa, saying that support for democracy, people who feel strongly positive about democracy, that number has been on the decline. Is that this data set or a different data set?
It's the same data set, right? Okay. So that controversy, I mean, you can pick your fighter in that one. People tended to took different, very different sides on that, and I think there's a lot of weight behind Mauck and Foa's argument, not least because it sort of jived with our intuitive understanding of what's happening in the world, data aside.
Right. And my recollection is that they showed a strong decline in the sector, a fraction of people who expressed strong support, but there's still support for democracy. It's just that the strong support has softened.
Exactly. And so, you know, I'm sure we'll get into some of the methodological questions in these data, that being one of them, right? How do we measure support for democracy? This is not an obvious question. Where do we do our cutoffs? What's the relevant mode of measurement? So these are obvious questions. But for me, I set out with a much more modest task. Just, you know, where on the political spectrum from left to right, which is very, very commonly deployed in our political analysis to understand the world, where is this threat most prominent? And my priors were very, very different. I set out to write a very different paper because my assumption was that the left was becoming more disgruntled than the right. And you could possibly attribute the rise in right-wing electoral power over the past 15 years to a kind of increasingly discontented view among the left-wing trends across nations. So I was very, very surprised. It felt very counterintuitive to me as I saw indicator after indicator that it was actually people who identified at the center of the political spectrum who were most hostile to democracy, most critical of its institutions, least committed to things like free and fair elections, and most supportive of authoritarianism.
So what kind of questions would lead to these attitudes being expressed?
So let's start with the democracy questions.
Yeah.
One question would be, one was a general democracy rating. What do you think about the system of democracy? Is it very good, somewhat good, fairly bad, or very bad? Other questions would be out of 10. So it would be, for example, how essential do you think free and fair elections are to democracy, where 10 is essential and 1 is completely inessential? People rate things out of 10. And again, I don't want to skip ahead because I'm sure we'll get to the questions around measurement. But you know, so you had wide ranges, not just in the types of questions, both in the types of questions and in the content of those questions. So others included, how essential do you think civil rights are to democracy? And then others are straight up, what do you think about a system of where a strong man ignores parliament or ignores Congress to implement his vision, right? And across this battery of questions, I found that it was people who identified at the center of the political spectrum who were far more hostile and far less committed to democracy than people on both the right and the left, although there were key differences between those.
Right. I'm looking at, you know, just to – I hesitate to pick one out, but like I'm really struck, for instance, by one of the figures. I encourage everybody to geek out with us and look up this paper. It's a really good paper. But in figure 4 of your centrist paradox working paper, which you can get, did I mention that you can get it by going to davidrkadler.info? So everyone pause this podcast and go look it up and go to figure 4, everyone. This is what happens when Julian gets out of town. Like I get to be the professor. Julian holds me back. But if we look there, like for instance, civil rights, the question, are civil rights essential? People on the far left are very interested in civil rights. And then on the far right, less so, right? So 70% think that civil rights are essential on the far left. 40% think civil rights are essential on the far right. But you had it at 25% at the center. So what, these people in the center don't think civil rights are essential?
It's a very curious thing and raises really big questions around who exactly these people are. I mean, you know, the takeaways from these data, which we'll explore in more depth, are many. You know, one of them, I'll highlight two just off the bat. the first takeaway for me was, and you can see this in other parts of my work where I call for a more accurate, for a more empirically grounded understanding of what these populist movements are, is that the left and the right are just not the same thing. You know, this horseshoe view that has really taken hold, that populism is one thing, and we can describe it in the same language as it's emerging on the left and the right and transnationally, it doesn't hold in the data. And one of the pieces I really like to illustrate this is the distinction between support for democracy and satisfaction. So support for democracy is really about the underlying principles. What do you think about democracy as a system? Now, the question of satisfaction can be completely different. So if you look at the satisfaction numbers across Europe and North America, it is the left, and in particular the far left, that is most dissatisfied. And this is a crucial distinction for making sense of what I think is, you know, these massive empirical flare-ups in our politics, where you certainly do have right-wing nationalists marching in the streets of Warsaw in the same way that you have young Corbynistas marching in the streets of London. But they could be expressing a very different sentiment. You know, it's very possible, what I found in these data and what I think is likely looking around, is that, you know, the left is expressing a distinct kind of dissatisfaction with the way the system is being run. But, you know, if the left has a big problem, it tends to be its obsession with democracy and horizontalism.
Right. So the idea being that democracy should reflect the will of voters, the will of citizens, and it's not. So there's something wrong with the institutions. I mean, my guess would be that the left would have the attitude of thinking democracy is good, but it seems to not really be working.
Exactly. So you have to distinguish between kind of an anti-system politics and an anti-incumbent system politics. You know, there's a looking for a kind of precision in what I think is quite a messy literature about populism. So that the first takeaway is really about trying to be a bit clearer about what happens when we dig a bit deeper into the democratic discontent literature. The second piece, which is really important, is the one you raised already, Sam, which is what the hell is going on in the center? Now, who are these people? And there's so much attention, scholarly and popular, that's paid to what's happening at the extremes, and for good reason. These people tend to say really wacky things. They're way sexier to study because many of them are nascent movements, and the center tends to be genuinely a quieter place that just attracts less attention, people who consider themselves to be, you know, not particularly motivated to get out in the street holding a tiki torch. Right. But, you know, there's real questions about who are these people and how are they thinking about the system and how are they, in the diachronic question, how are people who identify as moderates, how are they responding to the emergence of extreme movements and how is that reflected in their views of democracy as a political system?
Right. So let's get a little bit specific here. So you're finding here now, and everyone, listeners, please turn to figure two. on the far left, if asked the question, you know, those who agree with the statement, democracy is a very good political system in the United States. We're going to stay in the U.S. for a little while, then we can go to other countries. But right now, we're going to do the U.S. Democracy is a very good political system. On the far left, saying yes to that are about 57% of the far left. And then if we go to the far right, it's about 40%, a little over 40%. But at the center, it looks like it's at 32%. So there's this notch in your graph, which I want to come back to. But seemingly, the ones who say that democracy is a very good political system, that support is softest. It's really, it gets well below 50% at the center. And so this seems to speak to this thing that you found.
Yeah, so the American case, I think, is very particular in this regard because we have a very specific history of what the far right is. You know, again, just to use the counterexample of Europe, Europe has a much richer tradition of what we might understand to be the far right. So people, respondents in these surveys who are identifying at the far right are proclaiming their attachment to not fascism in particular, but a style of politics that really has, you know, a really long lineage in European politics.
Europeans know what it is to be far right.
Exactly.
Like if you're going to keep out the immigrants, if you're going to like put the whites on top, if you're going to, have whatever corporations in charge.
Throw your hand in the air.
Yeah, you know, right. People there lived through it. It got marched
exactly
across their territory in a pretty blunt sort of way, in their grandparents' lifetimes.
And in the United States, by contrast, our far right tends to be more associated with libertarianism, right? Which at least at the elite level, is deeply committed to democratic institutions, at least discursively, and but has a very particular view of how these sort of economic systems should be structured and the role of the government, right? So the center in the United States is a very curious place and a very messy place.
Do people in the U.S. know what it means to be center then, or far right or far left? Now I'm a little bit concerned about people's ability to report themselves.
Right. So in the working paper, I try to address the confusion around self-placement in a few ways. I use two in particular. One is I test left-right placements against policy views, namely about immigration and about economic fairness. So, do you prefer freedom or equality, which is a kind of classic right-to-left question. And both seem to signify, at least at first blush, that the center is appropriately the moderate position.
Okay,
The
so they get it
second,
right. They're
yeah, they get
self-consistent.
it right,
Okay, yeah, okay, good.
exactly. But the second, and I think far more convincing method for discarding the observations that are not don't speak to the core hypothesis about the role of the center, is that I exclude all the people who are politically disengaged. So I run my analysis on just those respondents who identify as somewhat or very interested in politics, right? So these are people who we might understand, we might say are have a clear understanding when they're answering the where do, are you from what from left to right 1 to 10 about acting with intention when they say, oh, I'm right in the center. And there, especially in the United States case, even non-apathetic centrists have display the same patterns of very, very low support for democracy and very high support for authoritarian governance instead. So it seems to be robust in the United States case to the inclusion of those two tests.
Yeah. So in your data, you've got this spike of people who report on a scale of 1 to 10 being left to right. Like a lot of people, about over 30% of people report being at 5. Like they put themselves right in the middle. And so their response pattern, so if we're going to take the sector of people who are the subject of what we're talking about today, they say, I'm such a centrist that I'm at 5 on a scale of 1 to 10. I think democracy is not such a great system. And I think it would be okay if a strong leader came in. So there's this sector of respondents who say all those things. Is that what we're getting at here?
Yeah, well, I think it's less messy than that. I think that there's broadly two varieties of centrism. The first is a kind of convicted centrism, which you might say belongs to a kind of third way-ish view of the world, right? These are people who believe in the center as a place of perhaps non-ideological common sense policy making. They believe in moderation as a virtue and are very skeptical of leaning either way in the political spectrum. And the second is a more apathetic centrism, a more mass centrism. We do find much higher levels of apathy in the center in the data, and that apathy is indeed correlated with stronger support for authoritarian governance. Right. And so that overlaps with technocracy. It's about having faith in a leader to do the work of politics for you. But it's more apathetic. Actually, I would add to that there's a third kind of centrism, which is a more ambivalent centrism. And this is something that's been explored by David Brookman at Stanford, which is that people are sort of torn between views on this side, some policy views on that side. They don't have a very coherent worldview, but because the left-right spectrum is such a simplistic way of understanding our politics, they find themselves sitting at the center. So
Do we
we've got
have
a soup of those three types.
any way of ruling out something like I think I accept this, but I do. I'm just curious. Do we have any way of ruling out an interpretation of something like everyone else is a nut, but I'm at the center?
Do we have a
So,
way of isolating
yeah,
those
it's like
people
people who
even?
subjectively say, I see a lot of junk on my news feed, on my television, and I got to say there's some nuts out there, and I'm right in the middle. I'm the good guy in the middle, and I proudly say I'm at a 5. And it could be a mix of people where it could be people who are truly actually on the left or truly actually on the right, but they think they're at the center. I mean, I realize that this is a bit of a reach, but I'm just curious as to whether we could test that idea.
Well, I mean, that's definitely a direction for further research from this paper. But I think that's exactly where I land, right? My sense is that there's two very distinct mechanisms here that are showing us this fairly striking phenomenon in the data. The first is the one you identified, which is a more diachronic one, one that's changing over time, where people say, "My God, things are really going crazy right now. This democratic process is ushering in some real Looney Tunes. into office, and this is not what I signed up for.
And therefore, it's okay to pitch democratic institutions?
I mean, I think, you know, it sounds implausible, but think about it.
I would say more horrifying than implausible. I actually am.
Well, you know, a lot of political scientists now are ripping apart the divide that the wall that we built between democratization theory and, you know, sort of mature democratic theory, right? We're realizing that wall didn't exist, wasn't as strong as it always was. And here is another good case of where that's probably true. If we look at, and this is a point I make in the New York Times piece, but if you look at cases in the global south of where strong men have come to power, it tends to be in the context of rapid change with threats emerging at the radical edges and supported by a base of middle-class moderates, people who are not particularly politically engaged and for their lack of engagement are much more susceptible to the appeal of an authoritarian leader saying, if you allow me to erode these nonsensical institutions, I can deliver you peace, stability, and prosperity. You know, and we have many of these cases around the world today. So I think, you know, the question for me is, in that first interpretation, you know, how many of these people are really feel so either disenfranchised as centrists, confused as centrists, or just angry about the state of things that they're willing to sort of throw up democratic institutions as a sacrifice for, you know, quelling the revolts that seems to be underway.
So in this interpretation, then, populism is not so much a left or right movement, but more of a revolt against elites, where there are systems that are in place that don't seem to be working very well, and whatever one may think, those systems are broken, and one way to fix things might be to pitch those systems.
I think that's right. All of what's happening, the big debate here, where I ultimately arrive with this paper and just thinking through these problems, is what is going to be our spatial model for, you know, the populist era of populist revolt? How should we understand in that, you know, Downsian space where people are? One of the key takeaways, implications of my findings, is that the left-right spectrum isn't helping us very much. It doesn't describe very well how people are making sense of their own politics. One, you could say, because of that Brookman thesis, that people have very diverse kinds of views. But the other, because it's just simply not the case that where you are in the left-right spectrum is telling us something important about your view, your preferences over populism. So,
but it does say certain things, like, for instance, like an affinity for civil rights, for instance. So certain things are still there. It's just this is more institutional that you're talking about.
Right. So you could say, you know, one of the – exactly. So, you know, it seems to me I believe we're living in a kind of firmly two-dimensional or perhaps three-dimensional world now, where you've got left-right as being a very, very relevant axis, and then you've got a kind of nativist liberal axis. And then I think you have a third axis, which is the one you mentioned before, which is the sort of elites, the populist axis.
And so this explains things like, for instance, if we're going to get away from the U.S. a little bit, explains things. I've been told that, for instance, in Spain, there are populist movements that are not particularly nativist. There's not a strong anti-immigrant sentiment there. Or perhaps or in Italy, where there's this new, I'm speaking as an American who's like kind of murky about foreign politics, but like in Italy, there's a new party that really kind of came out of the South, and that entertainer guy, what's his name? Beppo, I think.
Yeah.
And they don't seem to have strong political views, but they're anti-establishment, damn it. And whatever it is that's there, they're against it. But at the same time, they're insurgent without having clear policy views, it seems.
Exactly. These are sort of rage politics. I mean, it's really undermining our sense of the role that ideology plays in politics, which, you know, in all the conversation with the American debate for so long has been stalled on the question of polarization, our dominant anxiety. God forbid we move to the ends of the spectrum, right? And, you know, you could read the findings here as being further evidence that polarization is a problem because it's pushing people in the center to revolt against the system.
Because they have to pick a side.
Yeah, exactly. Or you can say polarization really isn't, you know, is a problem among others, and that what we have also is a kind of anti-system sentiment that is not particularly anchored in a view of the economy, which is fundamentally what the left-right spectrum
Well,
is
the way
about.
I'd put it is this, like now I'm just backing up a step here. So again, thinking about other countries, and it's not that typical in the U.S. to take a comparative approach because, you know, we're unique and special and nobody's like us. But anyway, so these far left and far right parties can often gain dominance. And so if we think about what's been happening recently in Germany with the Alliance for Deutschland, where they're gaining strength at the expense of the Christian Democrats, it seems that one way to interpret this is that we have the far left and the far right still committed to democratic institutions with very strongly held policy views. And we've got the center, which is maybe mushy or mixed or moderate, whatever one may say about their policy views, but they're willing to take down the institutions. And so it strikes me that that sets up a battle in which the far left or the far right, now their job is, okay, let's win over those people in the center. They may not feel strongly about the institutions, but we feel strongly about what we want as policy. And so if we can just grab those people and drag them towards us, then we can, you know, for instance, like one way to interpret the American dumpster fire that we've been observing over the last year and a half is that the Republican Party is weaker than it's been in some time. A total outsider, Donald Trump, came in and was able to harness this all these trends that have been bubbling for decades. And now there's this insurgency that's taken over the Republican Party. And so now, you know, there may be a lot of Americans who don't feel that strongly about policies, but they're willing to go with somebody who's going to tear down the system. I'm just trying to put these two things together, the polarization on the one hand and the willingness to pitch institutions on the other.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, the crucial distinction that I think you're raising here is between demand side and supply side politics. So what I'm looking at in this paper is very much the demand side story. Who are these voters and how do, and where do they sit in the left-right spectrum and how do they think about politics? What we're observing in America, I think, the way I would describe that process, is you've got is a really supply side story. You've got Trump, who in the course of the election pitched himself to all those discontented voters, most of whom would self-describe not at the far right, but precisely as moderates, right? Who would just say, "I'm just angry at the system," but because he can feed off of that anti-systemic sentiment, can drag people from the center toward, at this point, it seems like pretty much any policy view that he would like to advocate.
Well, so, how does that work? Because there are some pretty strange things that are happening in U.S. politics right now. Just the spectacle as we record this a couple of days ago, Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin on the national stage, where Trump gives every impression of being somewhat owned in some perhaps literal way by the president of Russia. And you know, the willingness to demolish various institutions of government as well as they can be demolished. So how does this work? Like, is public perception malleable enough to go along with these? Because if you look at opinion surveys, there haven't been that many opinion surveys since this thing that happened a few days ago. But up until then, close to 90% of Republican voters report being still favorable towards Trump. And so that's an interesting thought, that there's some pull that a party's leader can exert that much of a pull on the rank and file.
My honest opinion at this incredibly dark hour in American history is precisely yes, that the toxic combination of anti-systemic discontent and low levels of engagement are very ripe for this kind of, you know, this kind of madness, this kind of running around and dragging, you know, supply side dragging of voters pretty much anywhere on the political spectrum.
Uh-huh.
You know,
so if Trump goes away, it's going to happen again. Since it's happening around the world, let's say that, you know, we can see it in other countries. It's now happening in the U.S. And so what? Like, let's say Trump went away. He slipped on a banana peel, or Stormy Daniels got him in a dark alley and or Michael Avenatti or whatever. If he went away, it would happen again.
Well, it could, but you're raising these very, very complex questions about what is the relationship between elite politics and mass politics, which we tend to think have kind of mirror each other, but in reality, really don't. I mean, there is a big disconnect between the distribution of policy views at the elite level, where, you know, which includes newspapers and the media, as well as the political establishment, and at the base. And so, you know, I think that there's a tendency to try to read politics. Well, we have to read politics backward. But in our process of reading those politics backward, we tend to say, oh, well, it must be the case that this was an endorsement of a certain kind of policy. But, you know, the Brexit stuff in Britain, where I'm based now, is a fantastic case study, you know, where the really a lot of anxieties and discontent that was bubbling through the course of deindustrialization and the kind of castration of party politics, disconnection between voters and Westminster, that 30-year process was then given an outlet, a single referendum, where people could have the choice to voice that discontent. And of course, they voted, you know, for Brexit, not overwhelmingly, but at the median.
Right.
And what's the story there? Well, it must be the story of horrendous nativist racism. And that is a part, but it's a part that was led, you know, largely by the Daily Mail and by kind of elite level media and politicians who wanted to stoke that particular flame as much as they could. So,
but if you look at the geography of the Brexit vote, this is now 2 years ago, constituency by constituency, the Remain vote was really clustered in what I would call the UK's, I'm putting aside Scotland and Northern Ireland, which have lots of their own reasons. But if you look in England and Wales, the Remain contingent was very strongly concentrated in what I would call the elite parts of Britain, London, Oxford, Cambridge. And if you look at the Leave constituencies, they're all in the, what let's call it, the non-elite. And so it feels like it fits again. It could also be interpreted as people, whatever their views are, which we don't know from that data, but going against elites and saying, you know, you guys, the institutions have failed here and you are not serving us.
And the same is true in the Trump vote. And in some work that I'm doing now with Ben Ansell at Oxford, who's at Nuffield, we look at the housing market. So a lot of my work is focused on housing.
Right, housing in urban cities.
Exactly. Yeah. So Ben and I are just finished a paper, which is under review, looking at housing and populism across the United States in the election of Trump, Brexit here in Britain, and the election of Macron. And that's the runoff between Macron and Le Pen. What we find is a very simple, very clean relationship where areas that benefited from house price inflation, where you see high levels or rising over the past 15 years, levels of house prices, we find way less support for populist candidates. And where you have low levels of house prices, low levels of housing wealth, or declining wealth over the past 20 years, much, much higher rates of populist voting. Now, we attribute that to two particular effects. One is a wealth effect. So in the case of Britain, areas that have benefited, namely like the south of England or Paris, you're just richer areas. So they feel like they've, you know, gained materially. They have more to risk in electing some wild populist. But the other is what we call a weather effect, which is sort of that the housing market tells the story of which regions have gained and which regions have lost in the course of the last 25 years. And
right.
Vibrant areas, whether it's San Francisco or Los Angeles or New York or Miami for that matter, you know,
right.
Where you have an influx of young people who are pushing up those prices and where house prices really reflect, sort of behave like a weather vane, sort of telling, you know, saying, is it signaling economic vitality or in areas where it's signaling economic decline?
Right. Well, right? If you look at in the United States, again, at county by county data, some of the strongest shifts from Obama favoring counties to Trump favoring counties, a lot of those happen in Rust Belt areas, right? Northern Ohio, Western Pennsylvania, Indiana,
right.
Michigan. These states that were thought to be in some cases part of the blue wall, but there's this characteristic quality of places there where there's this strong movement from Democrats to Republicans. It seems to fit with the idea that right now forces within the Republican Party, whether they're Trumpist forces or non-college educated forces, somebody in that sphere has done a good job of pushing these so-called centrist buttons. And it suggests that, to put it into practical terms, that a thing that – I'm sorry to turn this into combat, but if the left wanted to win, then what they should do is find a way to harness those same people, and that it should be possible to harness them by whatever way. Like in the case of the far right in the United States, it might be cultural resentment, or it might be nativist sentiment, or it might be just resentment against elites. And so if there's a way for the left to harness that, then it feels like there's more more mobility in the U.S. system than one might imagine.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, my sense is that, and I'm happy to talk tactics and strategy, is that the biggest mistake that we could make on the left in America is running anyone that could be perceived as an establishment figure who can't speak credibly from the outside.
I see. So if we look at like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, right?
If she could run for president in 2020, I would honestly have it happen, because here we have someone who, again, can speak credibly both as a young person, a person who grew up in a working class family, who's never taken corporate donations, who hasn't been mixed up in the swamp for
she was working a year ago. She was working as a bartender.
And I think, I think that it's exactly the kind of refreshing, but we derided Drain the Swamp for some reason, but Drain the Swamp was brilliant in capturing the kind of resentment that people have. I mean, we really need to think about how we're redoing our mode of political engagement and our understanding of what Washington is and should be. So I think the lessons that we have learned or failed to learn from 2016 is precisely that, the having a candidate that was the most qualified in history, it turned out to be precisely the wrong reading. And I think that the data speak to this a bit, that there's a group of people who can very easily be mobilized by a message of change, of re-engagement, and of delivering on a kind of promise of change, I suppose, people who've sunk their heels into the swamp simply can't make that case credibly anymore.
Well, let's see. So we're a little short. We're running a little low on time. But what I'd like to do is just turn briefly to something you've written in the last few weeks. It's relevant to what you were just talking about, Mexico. There's a recent election in Mexico, and it seems to reflect some of the things you're talking about, because there, for the first time in something like five decades, a left party, Morena, has come to power, and this man, López Obrador, has become president. So there, that's a new breath in Mexican politics. Is there an extent to which that appears to be in some way harnessing this anti-establishment energy?
Absolutely. I mean, we could go very deep on the tremendous historical failures of the governing parties of the past 50-100 years in Mexico that have driven us to this landslide victory for a so-called left populist. But what I think is interesting, though, for this case, which throws a bit of a wrench into our conversation around populism, but again also builds on my broader skepticism of the sloppiness around this term, is the following. What, the core, when we use the word populist as slander, what we mean to say is that they're creating a false division in our society between a corrupt elite and a legitimate people, right? This is a very, we view this as a very pernicious kind of mode of political engagement, because it's very divisive and because it tends to overpromise whatever. In Mexico, what do you do with a case like Mexico, where that description is empirically accurate, where you have an elite who is corrupt and stealing from the people, and you have the mass of people who over the past 20 years have seen poverty levels rising and extreme poverty levels rising and have gained nothing that has accrued to the top. So you've got this left populist here who has been accused precisely for the populist label that he has earned of seeking to undermine democracy, undermine democratic institutions. But they do that on the basis of his very sloppy definition of populism that I would argue across North America and certainly in Latin America doesn't necessarily pertain to the left, which is steeped in a kind of commitment to democracy and, has radical ideas about where to move the economy. But whose radical ideas don't necessarily imply the sort of destruction of the democratic infrastructure in the way that many commentators have implied López Obrador will enact.
Yeah, earlier you said that political science, in some sense, theories are falling apart, but I think that might be a little bit too pessimistic. I would characterize, from hearing you describe Mexico, I'd think of it more as political science does a good job of describing things in what I, as a former physicist, would call operating in the linear range, where you see a machine or you see a physical phenomenon operating in some limited range, and you think, okay, that's what's going on. And so political scientists report that. And now we're doing these, inadvertently doing these experiments where, in this case of Mexico, we're seeing, I don't know, how strong are democratic institutions in Mexico? Are they going to respond to this when the Morena party attempts to address crime policy and corruption? Can they do it? And I feel like we're going to, so I, you know, in some sense, political science, I think, often gets interpreted as being predictive of the future. But it seems like it might be better to, one would call it a more successful field and less in crisis if we just say, well, it did a really good job of describing where things have been and helping us recognize when things have gotten out of range, and which is where we are now.
Well, you know, and just one last point that I want to make on the Mexican case, and I think that reflects back about how we understand what this thing called populism is and its prospects, you know, whether it's a healthy or a deleterious mode of political mobilization. You know, I recently wrote a piece called AMLO's López Obrador's his double bind, in which I make the case that, you know, poor guy, he's really screwed either way. Either he succeeds in implementing his policy vision, which will require a massive revolution in Mexico's institutional form, which Mexico's institutions are rotten to their core. So he'll really have to rebuild the Mexican state from the ground up. And if he does that, of course, he'll be accused of being an authoritarian and of falling prey to the populist trap. He'll be just like the others, right? Concentrating too much power on himself because he had to implement this ambitious agenda. Yeah. But of course, if he fails to implement that ambitious agenda, then he's just another false prophet. Because clearly populism promises too much, and that's why we should never trust populists. And I'm deeply concerned about this non-falsifiable, or, you know, finding your way out of the populist box is extremely difficult. Because the only way to prove that you're not a populist, the only way for Macron, for example, to prove that he's not a populist is to be extremely unpopular and to be broadly status quoist. I think that this term is both analytically unhelpful, but also pernicious in the popular vote conversation about what the direction is for radical politics. Mm-hmm. And perhaps it's speaking, you know, I'm showing my cards here as advocating a kind of radical change in response to the system failures that we've seen. But I'm worried about the traps that we're finding, where the only way to prove to people that, you know, you aren't a demagogue is to do nothing.
Yes. I will say that in reading your work, as you refer to this piece that you wrote for Verso, which I enjoyed very much, that you do show your cards in your writings. I think that's a good thing, and it's also good to be well-rooted in data and analytics, which you are as well. So I've been fascinated by this combination of wearing your heart on your sleeve and also sticking with the data, and I very much appreciate that.
Well, thanks very much.
All right, so we are out of time. I want to thank David Adler for joining us today on Politics and Polls. This is the Princeton University Woodrow Wilson School podcast. You can read more about David Adler's work at davidrkadler.info, and you can find all the columns that he's mentioned that we've talked about today on that site. You can find Politics and Polls, any fine purveyor of podcasts near you, including iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, and Podomatic. And with that, I'm Sam Wong, and I wish you all well. Take care.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.